Welcome to the Defiant Podcast. Each week, we sit with those defying traditional finance and legacy institutions, the biggest brains and biggest names, and also those making a quieter but profound impact, the founders, investors, and creators of decentralized finance and Web3. You'll hear from them right here and get the scoop on how they're building at the frontier. I'm your host, Defiant founder Camila Russo, putting this new world within your reach. Here we are with Jill Gunter. Jill, it's so great to have you on the Defiant Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I am a longtime fan, so it's a privilege to be here.
Jill Gunter is the co-founder and chief strategy officer at recently launched scaling solution Espresso Systems and a venture partner at Slow Ventures. Jill fell into the crypto rabbit hole as she was trading emerging markets debt with Goldman Sachs. She became interested in Bitcoin because of its potential to help those in corrupt or repressive regimes find financial freedom. So how did it all start for her? To swap crypto, a user has to choose among hundreds of DEXs on multiple networks, all offering different rates and fees. Do you want to avoid that hassle? Swap on 1inch, a DEX aggregator that gets you the best rates than any single DEX. Enjoy the unlimited liquidity across multiple networks and top-level security. Try 1inch now.
It's funny because I have been in crypto in some capacity in the sense of owning Bitcoin and toying around with things, I guess, for 8 or 9 years now. And I've been working in the space for 6 or 7 years. In any other industry, working in that industry for 6 years, that's a solid amount of time, but it doesn't sort of make you feel like you're one of the ancient people sort of still hanging around. But by virtue of the nature of crypto and by virtue of the fact that it's so nascent, even still, it does, as you say, it can make me feel like it's been a long and winding road already. But to go back to the beginning, I mean, I basically got into Bitcoin initially while I was working on Wall Street. I was working on a Latin American sovereign debt trading desk. And so I was dealing with the sovereign debt of countries like Argentina, which at the time was going through a debt default and restructuring, as well as Venezuela, which at the time was experiencing very high rates of inflation. It wasn't yet at the point of hyperinflation that it later got to, but it was my colleagues in those places that started talking to me about Bitcoin back in, I guess it would have been 2012, 2013. About getting their money offshore using Bitcoin and about just kind of this new technological tool of empowerment, I guess, that they were suddenly experimenting with. And so it was that really kind of first opened my eyes to the space, and the rest has been history.
What trading desk were you with?
So I was working with Goldman Sachs in New York, and I think that a big part of my attraction to working in finance was the sort of constant 24-hour news cycle nature of financial markets, and also the kind of geopolitical nature frequently of financial markets. Both of my parents had worked on Wall Street themselves, and I kind of grew up in a house with Bloomberg and CNBC always on the TV. And yeah, I loved that element of it. And so that attracted me to, as I mentioned, the sort of Latin America group, the Latin American trading desk, where there was a lot more volatility. And for me, just a lot more kind of interest in interesting scenarios than certainly I would have found in, for example, US equities or anything like that.
That's so interesting. Maybe you read some of my Argentina stories back then. So I was covering the Argentina like default and wrote a daily credit column, which I can't believe it was actually a daily column, Argentina credit.
I can't actually remember if I'd read them at the time, but as I have subscribed to the Defiant newsletter and followed the podcast and so forth, I have looked back at your work on the Argentine debt crisis. And it is funny how for so many of us, it seems like that was this kind of defining moment in terms of wake up of what the potential and power of Bitcoin, because that was all there really was at the time, but cryptocurrency in general could be. And I knew that about you. I also vividly remember reading Nathaniel Popper's columns at the time about how Bitcoin was being used in Argentina. Someone who's become a good friend to me since then, James Downer, started writing in CoinDesk, which of course was just like a very nascent publication at the time, wrote a few articles about Bitcoin in Argentina. And yeah, even for those of us, the gringas who are not Argentine, referring to myself here, of course, it was this sort of, eye-opening and defining moment.
That's so crazy. So I'm not Argentine either, but like, as you know, I'm Chilean, and it's like, it's traditionally very, a lot more stable there than in other countries in Latin America. But just like being in Argentina, covering all the craziness of that market with inflation and like these kind of defaults every like decade or so, or like recently it's like even more frequent, and just like their history with financial institutions and like the Corralito and all of that. Yeah, like it really kind of drives home the point of you really need some form of uncensorable, permissionless money.
Absolutely. And I, when I left Wall Street, I had intended to go back to school and get a master's, or potentially I had in the back of my mind at the time, maybe a PhD in political economics, in order to then go back to Wall Street and go back into finance and you know, hopefully be an economist at some macro hedge fund or something like that. That was sort of the game plan. And I initially applied to write a master's degree and do research on a very sort of like cut and dry, like economics oriented topic that was still going to intersect with like Latin America and geopolitics. But I basically spent that summer before I started grad school going really deep down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, to the point where by the time I got to grad school, I went into my professors the first day and I was like, I want to study this Bitcoin thing instead. And I think that they were all quite skeptical at the time, but they let me do it. And it was this amazingly informative experience where I actually ended up studying specifically Argentina and capital controls and the role that Bitcoin was or was not playing in terms of capital control evasion, which the upshot of it was that it was a very, very kind of negligible role at the time. And it was also just very eye-opening to me in terms of all of the avenues of capital control evasion that have always been open to people, but often not accessible to kind of the average individual in a given country. It's often these avenues that are open only to kind of the privileged few who have that access. But that was a very informative experience for me, just in terms of understanding where and how something like Bitcoin might be useful then. This is back in like 2015, but also where it could be useful in the future. And of course, that's become highly hot button topic and issue, of course, over the last few weeks, even what with what's going on with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and questions around whether Russia is using crypto for capital control evasion, or whether, I mean, it seems like the overwhelming evidence around Ukraine is that Ukraine has been able to successfully use crypto, not for any kind of evasion, but just as an efficient way of garnering funds and support. And so it's amazing to see these things that felt so nebulous and uncertain at the time that you were writing about them and I was researching them, all of these years later start to become actually quite relevant and meaningful.
Yeah. So I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on how crypto is being used in the Ukraine and Russia conflict. Because it's right, like some people have argued crypto has been an instrument for Russia to evade sanctions, so it's kind of seen as this instrument for like evil, I guess. But then like on the other hand, it's also helped bring supplies into Ukraine, or help like Russians, like everyday Russians and Ukrainians protect their savings. So I don't know if there's like a clear-cut view on the role that crypto is playing in the conflict. Like, I think it really depends on like what side you're standing or kind of what like where you're looking at it from. But yeah, I'd love to kind of hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, it is this kind of age-old question, right? Of when you have a new tool or technology platform, especially when that tool is kind of open and boundaryless and permissionless in the way that crypto is, it's this question that arises of, is it being used for good or for evil? How do we control the ways in which it's being used? And I think that on some level, that's one of the most important things that we as builders and entrepreneurs and contributors and even users of all of these really nascent tools and platforms can be asking ourselves, because it's easy to put blinders on and be focused on building the form of the future that we are so optimistic about without thinking, of course, about the second order knock-on effects. And if you look back just a few years ago in a very different space in the social media space, it's very easy to trace a line with, for example, Facebook from decisions that they were making, again, in probably a very optimistic way, to things like Cambridge Analytica or debates around the 2016 election and so forth. So I think it's a really important conversation to be having, and I'm grateful that the community is having it. I would say, though, that a lot of the conversation specifically around Russia as a country somehow using crypto to evade sanctions, at least the conversation that has been happening within certain pockets of the media and also within the US political establishment, does feel like it's sort of a red herring almost, in that it's a distraction. It is pointing to issues where there's very little evidence that they would even be possible to arise, let alone that they're actually happening. And this is something that Treasury is saying over and over again themselves. Like, there is no evidence that Russia, the country, is using crypto for sanctions evasions. And there's no evidence, again, that they would even be able to on any kind of scale, given just the liquidity profile of crypto, and also given the fact that, in general, crypto is actually very, very easy to trace and keep track of where it's moving and between whom. Again, especially when you're talking about the scale of an entire country's financial system. I would also say, though, that you bring up sort of individual Russians, you know, potentially being able to use Bitcoin or cryptocurrency as some kind of an escape hatch for themselves in the face of the devaluation of the ruble and so forth. And there, again, I do kind of hearken back to the research that I did, I guess, gosh, 6-7 years ago now, around Argentina, which really just highlighted to me again the fact that at the country level, or even indeed at the level of big institutions within the country or the sort of wealthy ruling class, where there is access to other financial tools and other financial systems, there are and always have been other escape hatches that have nothing to do with cryptocurrency that do allow for capital controls evasion. And I think that we would be much better served to, when we do, when the US political establishment or the media or whoever, we as individuals within the industry do talk about these things with regards to crypto, I do really think it's important to put it in the context of all of the other ways in which countries and institutions do evade these things. Whether, again, that's capital control sanctions, I mean, even taxation, right? That was a big narrative around crypto itself for a while there. And so I think it's important to put it in that context. The last thing I'll just say quickly is that I think where there is overwhelming evidence is the overwhelming evidence that Ukraine has been able to use crypto, not, again, not to evade anything, not to get around any kinds of controls or regulations that are in place, but merely as an improved way of gathering funds and support and moving money across borders in a quick and accessible manner. And that has been, I think, for many of us who've been building in crypto for a long time, a very kind of heartening demonstration of the value that can be created by this technology in the form of an improved infrastructure. And so that's very exciting. But these are certainly complicated and important issues for all of us to be keeping an eye on and to be considering as we're building.
It's been so interesting to see how crypto has become pretty kind of almost central to the conflict, or to the way kind of money is being moved as a result of the conflict. Like, yes, for Ukraine, like it's enabled their Ukrainian government to raise like over 100 million in funds from crypto donations. This week in the Defiant video team is shooting an amazing segment on how this actual, like, also video producer from Ukraine is using crypto to get supplies over to the like front line, because they're having so many issues in getting just like payments done through the like regular banking system. So they're actually using crypto. Like this woman who had nothing to do with crypto before had like didn't have a way of like getting these supplies over. So she was like forced to kind of use crypto for that. So you see these examples.
Incredible.
And yeah, and then from the side of like capital controls, evasion. Yeah, I think that's a great point you bring up. Like, maybe Russians are using crypto, but it's not like they wouldn't be using something else if crypto wasn't available. It's not as if crypto is like the only way to evade capital controls. I mean, back to like Argentina, I remember like humans just will find a way to evade controls.
I remember speaking to someone and him telling me the story of literally he was in touch with someone who was smuggling US dollars into Argentina at the time. And mm-hmm. this acquaintance of his who he would deal with would literally have to take suitcases of cash, dollars cash, on a boat from Uruguay into Argentina and evade, mm-hmm. like they would have sniffer dogs on the boat,
yes.
trained to sniff out cash. And it's like, as you say, just sort of the human spirit, if your livelihood, if your financial well-being is being put into question, there are ways to be found. And I think it's so important to put it in that context. But I would love to hear if you had a similar anecdote or tale from your experience of covering all of that.
Oh yeah. Like, yeah, I remember the sniffer dogs for sure in the ferry from Punta del Este in Uruguay. So yeah, people, instead of having, they had dogs trained to like sniff out drugs, but also dogs trained to sniff out dollars in suitcases. It's
crazy.
Pretty wild. And then the other thing they also did in Punta del Este in the casino is that, so in the casino, you were able to buy chips with your credit card, and that was kind of in dollars at like the official rate, so not the kind of or it was like in dollars at the rate in like at the market rate in Uruguay. So they were able to like buy casino chips with their credit card, and then they would just like cash them in. Like they wouldn't like use them to play. They would like just like use them as like
a vehicle
of just like getting
an
dollars.
An exchange and then, mechanism to get cash.
Yeah, it was, wow. Yes. So they would like cash in their chips, and then the casino would like pay it directly like in cash. So they would get like dollars to bring back to Argentina. So yeah, I mean, there's a way.
Absolutely wild.
Yeah, yeah.
There's always a way.
Jill had already been Bitcoin-pilled when she went off to grad school, so she took the opportunity to use those years and dive deeper into crypto, investigating how Bitcoin was being used to skirt currency controls. After that, there was no turning back. So how was that transition from Wall Street to blockchain? When you shop for plane tickets, you probably use Kayak, Expedia, or Google Flights. So why would you limit yourself to just one exchange when you trade crypto? To make sure you're getting the best possible price, you should use a DEX aggregator like Matcha. Matcha routes your orders across all the various DeFi exchanges on Ethereum, Polygon, Avalanche, BSC, Phantom, Celo, and Optimism. With Matcha, you can make limit orders on-chain,
So you can set and forget your DeFi trades, and now Matcha even offers gasless trading. Head over to matcha.xyz/defiant and connect your wallet to start smarter with Matcha.
Yeah, my friends from who knew me when I was living in New York working in finance joke that I got lost on the way to Greenwich, Connecticut, ended up in Silicon Valley instead. Basically, while I was in graduate school, this was 2015 kind of timeframe, I started applying to every company that was doing anything in crypto, of which at the time there were about a dozen. It was not that many. And I was fortunate enough to get a job at a company called Chain, which started out doing Bitcoin developer tooling and then pivoted into kind of enterprise blockchain. So they had partnerships with NASDAQ and Citigroup and so forth. And I was doing business development and strategy for them. So that was my first foray into crypto full time. And then, as you mentioned, I've been able over the last, 6 years or so to have kind of a wide-ranging path through investing venture capital on behalf of Slow Ventures, which is a great seed stage fund based in San Francisco, generalist fund, but does a lot in crypto and Web3. And then I've also been able to serve as an advisor to a couple of different companies, L1s in the space. I actually co-founded, along with Alejandro Machado and Jamal Montesor, two good friends and amazing designer friends of mine, design research lab called the Open Money Initiative that was looking into how crypto is not being used in places with financial restrictions. So still very much along the same lines of what we were talking about. There are these threads of thematic consistency, even as it's been a fairly broad and wide-ranging career path over the last 6 years or so.
Nice. So you've been kind of like observing how crypto is being used where there's financial restrictions. I'm curious, seeing how it's being used today compared with how it was being used in Argentina, what do you think has changed? Because you mentioned that in Argentina, you saw like very little evidence that it was being used in a meaningful way. Like maybe there was like a very kind of small, like niche group of people who were using crypto, but it wasn't like mainstream by any means. My perception is that has changed. I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts on what you're seeing. Like, is it more widely adopted now? And if yes, what do you think has contributed to that?
Certainly, I mean, globally, it's much more widely adopted. I'm not up on the stats in terms of where it is in terms of adoption in a place like Argentina or Venezuela, where I also spent time. But I do think that certainly without doubt, globally, it is much more widely adopted. And I can only imagine that would be even more true in these places that we're talking about. I think that I would attribute that to a few things. I think that first and foremost, it's just broader awareness and education. And a lot of the research that I've done in talking to people who are facing these types of circumstances, again, inflation, capital controls, et cetera, the main reason why they're not using cryptocurrency, if they're not, is just that there was a lack of familiarity with it. Frequently, a lack of even knowledge that such a thing exists, right? But then when there is knowledge that such a thing exists, there's, again, just a lack of comfort with it of, oh, I've heard of that thing, but, you know, it sounds really complicated or highly technical, or else I don't know if it's fully legal or the government can come after me or something like this for using it. And I think that as education, like podcasts and newsletters like yours, has helped to make it much more mainstream. Then we've also seen follow on from that, of course, a much greater proliferation of easy and accessible on and off ramps into and out of crypto that span globally, right, as well, importantly, that are not just Coinbase and Gemini in the US, although they're great and they do great work. for a long time, the main options for on and off ramps in some of these locales was just local Bitcoins. And Local Bitcoins is an amazing company and amazing service, and they are some of the originals. But I do think that a big important catalyst has been the development of more local exchanges that can serve as centralized on and off ramps. So that's been, I think, a huge evolution over the last several years.
Yeah, for sure. I'm really happy to see that, and how, like, in Argentina, like, crypto is so mainstream right now. Like, it's incredible. Like, people are just like using it for like everyday life, like for savings,
amazing, and
for purchases. So yeah,
I would love to go back.
It's been amazing to see that. Yeah, me too. Yeah. Like, I've been speaking to so many Argentines. Like, I went to ETH.RIO and it was like, I don't know, 80% Argentine. So got to kind of talk to them about how they're using crypto, and yeah, like they were saying, it's just like pretty much mainstream by now. So it gave me like so much, like, I don't know, a lot of nostalgia, like, oh. So I'll find an excuse to go.
Absolutely. But it's that kind of vision of what crypto can look like as it goes mainstream, whether it's in a place where it was sort of forced to go mainstream, I guess, like Argentina, where there were these dynamics that we've been talking about, or whether it's as we think about stablecoins going more mainstream for payments, maybe even in the United States or in a business-to-business capacity, all of these types of things. It was a lot of consideration and almost kind of soul searching that I've done over the last few years of what will need to be true if and when we reach that point. And that is a big part of what drove me to want to focus on building solutions for both scalability and really specifically privacy. So frequently I would be talking to people in the form of either interviews or just at conferences or getting to know each other and so forth. And they would start talking about, in these really inspiring ways, the ways that they were starting to use crypto in a more day-to-day capacity. And in the back of my mind, I would just be kind of thinking like, oh gosh, but you're doxing your complete financial information, your whole financial life. You're broadcasting that out to the world. And talking to people about that, and they're sort of initially frequently kind of the perspective of, oh yeah, but no one's really looking at what I'm doing, or it doesn't matter so much. But again, as you think about these things potentially going more and more mainstream, it may start to matter even for people who think no one's looking or think that they would have nothing to hide.
Espresso Systems is Jill's latest endeavor and recently raised over $32 million in funding to bring scalability and privacy to Web3. Those are the tools Jill believes are fundamental if Web3 is to truly go mainstream. So what's Espresso's founding story? And how does it work?
In 2021, Ethereum traders lost over $240 million to malicious bots exploiting their trades. Eden Network is a next-generation private transaction service for Ethereum, providing traders with MEV protection by submitting transactions directly to miners and away from the prying eyes of harmful bots. Eden Network recently launched Eden Rocket RPC, which compiles some of Ethereum's fastest private transaction networks. Join and get started now at rpc.edennetwork.io.
Yeah, absolutely. So Espresso Systems is the company that I'm working on building at the moment with an amazing team. We're about 26 people currently, about 18 of whom are engineers. And then there's four of us who are the co-founders of it. So it's myself and then three incredible cryptography PhDs, one of whom is a PhD dropout. The other two are full on still in or just after the throes of academia from Stanford, Ben Fish, Charles Liu, and Benedict Bunz. And we are building the scaling and privacy functionality that we think that Web3 will need in order to go mainstream in these ways. And where we've started with that is a privacy application that works on Ethereum and will work even better, we think, on the underlying protocol that we're building out for it over this coming year. And that's called CAPE, Configurable Asset Privacy, on Ethereum. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is to be able to take existing ERC-20s and ERC-721s, and also to enable the development of new assets and new tokens that have, as the name suggests, configurable privacy policies around them. And so to answer your first question about kind of the origin story of all of this, I had had in my mind over the course, really, I guess, of 2018, 2019, through DeFi summer, I was watching kind of a lot of not only the DeFi-oriented products take off, but also the DeFi-enabling products take off, specifically stablecoins. Mm. All of the stablecoin growth curves were just hockey sticks over the course of this period. And at the time, I was working in venture capital. And of course, as a venture capitalist, we were watching these types of growth curves and trying to ask yourself the important questions of what needs to be built in order to maintain those growth curves, in order to catalyze them further. And I started thinking about the notion of a privacy-enabled stablecoin, something a bit different from what already existed in terms of what you could do with stablecoins with Tornado Cash, something a bit different from what already existed in terms of privacy-oriented cryptocurrencies, not necessarily stablecoins, but things like Zcash and Monero, but a privacy-oriented stablecoin that could meet the needs, for example, of a business that wants to be able to have some transparency and some controls perhaps over what they're doing, but don't necessarily want to be broadcasting all of their activity to the whole world. Or indeed, you could imagine this being applicable also in some of the examples that you and I talked about just a few moments ago in terms of the types of things that people might want to maintain privacy around. And as I was just sort of thinking about and considering and brainstorming around this idea, I reached out to a couple of old friends who I knew had done some work around privacy, namely Ben in this case, and started talking to him about this. And he was sort of saying, oh, well, funnily enough, I'm working in a similar direction. And we just incorporated a company and why don't you consider coming on board, which I very happily did. And so that's kind of the origin story of Espresso Systems. And that's the use case that we started with. We have come to expand kind of the scope of what we're building. And I think that this is how so many of the great crypto projects out there have gone about building, is that they start with a very specific application in mind or a very specific use case, and then realize as they go about building it, oh, wait, we need to build the primitives and the protocols and all of the kind of infrastructure technology in order to make this possible. And so again, that's where we're starting with configurable asset privacy for Ethereum, this CAPE product that we recently open sourced and that we'll be launching on testnet in a few weeks' time. So stay tuned. And that's a little bit more also about where we're going with the company.
Very cool. So, okay. So first question on this, like CAPE, if I understand it, is that a separate blockchain, or is that like a protocol built on top of Ethereum that enables like privacy transactions or private transactions?
Yeah. I should say. Great question. So there is what we refer to as the CAP protocol, the configurable asset privacy protocol, which is, I mean, as protocols are basically sort of the rule sets around how privacy can be enabled and privacy can function. That protocol can be implemented on any EVM chain. So it can be implemented on Ethereum. We are also building out what we refer to as the Espresso Layer 1, which will enable all of these things to be possible in a much more scalable way. That's, of course, one of the big problems with rolling these things out on Ethereum today, particularly anything privacy-oriented. But so we will be implementing the configurable asset privacy protocol natively on our infrastructure once that's ready. But again, it could be really supported on any of this infrastructure. What we've built as the starting place while our infrastructure is under construction, if you will, is an instantiation of this protocol on Ethereum. Again, we're starting on testnet, of course. So we'll be live on the Gorli testnet in just a few weeks' time. And that lives as a smart contract on Ethereum. Part of the beauty, I guess, of Ethereum's Turing completeness is that we were able to implement it. Just really, you can think of it as an application on Ethereum. And so today, CAPE is, as I say, an app on Ethereum that you can interact with just as you would any other smart contract or application on Ethereum. And then later down the line on the roadmap is an implementation of it on our own layer one, where again, we'll have all kinds of scalability benefits and also importantly, potentially some privacy benefits too. So.
And what can you do with this application? Like how does it work?
Yeah, great. So first and foremost, if you are an asset creator, so let's say you're one of the big stablecoin issuers, just to go back to that as an example, but equally, you could be a DeFi project with your own governance token. You could be a DAO figuring out governance or your own payroll. You could be an NFT artist. You could be any kind of asset creator, but let's just use stablecoins for a moment because that's intuitive. If you're an asset creator, you can create an asset using CAPE that you have control over who can see what about what's going on with that asset. Mm. And so if you're a big stablecoin provider, you might want to say, okay, I, as the provider here, am going to serve as the trusted third party in terms of what I can see is going on the network, but I'm going to offer improved privacy over and above what exists on Ethereum or pretty much other blockchain today to my end users. And so I'm going to say, I will retain visibility into what's happening with this stablecoin that I'm creating within CAPE. But then if I am a user of the stablecoin and I want to send you a payment using that stablecoin, then the general public will not any longer be able to go on Etherscan and see that I paid you $1,000 for rent this month, or that I paid you $5 for the coffee that you bought me yesterday. But rather, the stablecoin provider would still be able to see that, which might be important to them for any kinds of controls that they might want to have, or any kind of data integrity or reporting requirements or anything like that that they might want to retain. And so that's one example of how an asset creator might use CAPE to create a fundamentally new kind of user experience.
Would the assets created still be ERC-20s?
So that's a great question. And the answer is if you want. So if you are a stablecoin provider who already has ERC-20 stablecoins that exist on Ethereum, then what you could do is use CAPE to create basically a wrapper, a template kind of, wherein I, again, as an end user, could take some of my existing ERC-20 stablecoins, wrap them into that template, get the privacy properties that the stablecoin provider is providing to me here. So again, maybe it's privacy from the general public, but they can still see what's going on. Importantly, also, I as a user can see that they can see what's going on. It's flagged in big red writing to me, at least on the user interface that we've developed for it. And so that's an important element too. And so yes, I could be able to do that with an ERC-20 token, but equally the asset creator might decide, okay, I'm just going to create a brand new type of stablecoin within CAPE. That's really up to them, but there is that interoperability supported.
So would, like, for example, if Circle and Coinbase wanted to issue a more private USDC, would, like, if they used CAPE to do that, it would be like a wrapped USDC, like, I don't know, like WUSDC, or it, like, I don't know if it's going to be called CUSDC or something like that.
Right now, internally, we've been calling these assets CAPED assets, sort of like they're cloaked or wrapped. But yeah, that's the idea. And I mean, that's obviously very hypothetical. It would be a very cool scenario to see if this picked up and used by the likes of such big providers like that. But yeah, that's exactly the idea.
And does it have to come from the issuer, or would like a USDC holder be able to go and like keep their USDC?
So yeah, potentially other parties, so whether that's individuals or other sort of service providers, could go in and create their own wrapped type of USDC that has their own privacy parameters around it and their own viewing capabilities and all of that. I think that from our perspective, thinking about it from kind of a product perspective and even a go-to-market perspective, there's a big question there of how those types of players would end up driving adoption to it if it's not sort of the issuer. And so that's why we tend to talk about it with the actual sort of original asset creators in mind. But it is, if you wanted to go out and create a defiant wrapped version of some ERC-20 on CAPE, then we can't stop you. No one's going to stop you. It's a totally open protocol. And that's something that I'm actually really excited as we go live on testnet to see the ways in which people do pick up and use the technology, because we certainly have not thought of all of them. And it may well be the case that that ends up being much more interesting to people than even we've anticipated. So that's something I'm really excited for.
Very cool. I mean, would CAPE support the common like privacy transaction use case of like simply kind of scrambling transactions or just enabling more like private kind of transfers,
like blanket
of
privacy
value?
I mean the way that we see the world is that today in crypto, you have this kind of black and white notion of privacy that exists, where you have Monero on one end of the spectrum, and then you have Bitcoin and Ethereum and everything else on the other end of the spectrum, where it's just all or nothing. It's either you are trying to keep everything private from all people all the time, including maybe even the government or whatever, or you're comfortable with everyone seeing everything that you're doing and you're just doxxed constantly. And we think that both ends of those spectrums are pretty well served with the products that exist. And so what we're really focused on is building products that create, we think, much more expansive and interesting room in the middle of that spectrum. And so CAPE is really designed for the kind of gray area there in terms of being able to configure situations and specifically assets in which some people need to or want to retain the benefits of transparency, which are also very real, while also offering privacy as a feature and as a function for end users. And that's also reflected, again, in the user interface that we've created, where in the user interface, you have to designate what we call viewing keys for each asset. It's not even an option in the user interface to have it be sort of fully private, I think, in the way that you're talking about. And again, that's a very proactive decision, because there are tools for that end of the market, and that is just not the opportunity, certainly, that we're going after.
All right. So if like who decides, like the issuer decides who can actually see everything, right? Like, going back to the circle, so like circle would still be able to see all the information there, but like not the holder of the asset.
Yeah, and so in that example, and there are many different ways of configuring this, but in that example specifically, what you're doing is you're replicating basically the privacy parameters of the traditional financial system, right? Where I am perhaps as an American who trusts my bank and kind of trusts the government, I am happy for Chase Bank to be able to see all of the data on the transactions that I'm making in and out of my bank account. But I certainly would not want everyone I know to be able to see all of those transactions. And so again, this example specifically that we're on with the stable coins, that I think is kind of a reflection of the way that TradFi works and approaches privacy. But I think that what is most exciting to me is the ways that that can even be enhanced or improved upon or altered in much more kind of creative and novel ways. And so one example of this would be if, for example, to stick with the stablecoin for a second, if a stablecoin provider decided that, okay, transfers under a certain threshold, we don't need to see anything about at all. That's fine. Mm. That can be fully private, but transfers above a certain threshold for our own reporting requirements or for our own internal data integrity, we need to be able to have insight into that. And we want to leverage all of the transparency benefits of Web3 and crypto. Then they, in future versions of CAPE, would be able to program that natively into the asset so that they can have only the insights that they need. And so it's areas like that where we can actually improve over the privacy that's offered in traditional systems today that I think excite me most.
Very cool. Super interesting. Right. So you're able to improve on how TradFi works now and also kind of open the door for banks and institutions, like financial institutions, to potentially feel more comfortable using DeFi.
That's one of the hopes. Yeah. I think that one of my big theses or theories about the next 5 years of crypto is that up until now, the big players have basically been individuals or institutions that either got in early, so like some of the big venture funds, or institutions that are crypto native, right? That grew out of individuals or startups or venture funds that were started within crypto itself, or trading outlets that were started within crypto itself. And I do think that one big area of growth, again, over the next 5 years or so, will be more traditional financial institutions getting in. And I think that this type of privacy guarantee will be very important as a way to opening up those floodgates. I also, however, think that there are a lot of amazing applications of configurable privacy outside of purely enterprise, where we've spoken to NFT artists who are excited to be able to offer NFTs in a more privacy-preserving way for their users, while they themselves, as the artist, might be able to then maintain insight into who owns their art and how it's moving around and things like that. And so I think that that's just another example of sort of the range of options that will be created and the range of users that I hope and I foresee CAPE and down the line Espresso more broadly serving.
Very cool. Briefly, can you kind of touch on the tech that you're using? Is it like zero knowledge?
It's zero knowledge based. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so probably most of your listeners are familiar, but zero knowledge proofs, zero knowledge technology, it's a cryptographic mechanism to be able to prove that certain things are true while not having to disclose the underlying data that would otherwise prove that. And these have been researched and developed in academia for quite some time and were first commercialized actually in the form of Zcash, which of course came out back in 2014. And since then, there has just been an explosion of developments and greater research and engineering breakthroughs in the zero knowledge space, where a lot of the challenges that, all credit to the Zcash team, they were able to kind of blast through and pioneer through. A lot of those challenges have either become moot or been diminished with time. These are challenges related to everything from what's called the trusted setup that was previously needed to be done each time for every Zcash upgrade and so forth. There are now systems that have been developed that greatly improve upon that, where you can use what's called a universal setup, where everyone is sort of contributing to it, and therefore everyone can have kind of enhanced and improved trust that it's secure and it's going to work the way that it's supposed to and it hasn't been compromised. All kinds of developments like that that just make the tech, I think, really ripe to underpin a lot of different breakthroughs. And so it's been an exciting thing to be a part of, and it's a really exciting space and area to be working on.
Tech has unforeseen consequences. A prime example of this is social media and Web2. What was designed to connect friends evolved into data breaches and misuse of information. So what are the potential unforeseen consequences of crypto? Are we starting to see glimpses of that with CBDCs? Jill is optimistic.
BearX recently launched USDS, a decentralized stablecoin that automatically generates passive income for holders. USDS is a hybrid stablecoin, part backed by cryptocurrencies and part by the protocol's ability to mint and burn the governance token SPA. The yield is generated organically via external DeFi applications to ensure sustainability of the system. Thanks to the auto yield, it pays to hold USDS. Go to app.sparex.io and mint your own USDS today.
Yeah, look, I think that they could be. I think that they certainly have the potential to go the route of surveillance and sort of an overstepping of government controls in terms of what people are doing with their money and so forth. But I don't think that they have to be. And I think that there is this tendency within people who've been in crypto for a while and perhaps have seen things go south before to get very worried when they hear things like CBDCs talked about. And I appreciate that those conversations are happening. But the way that I look at central bank digital currencies is that if they were to come about and if they were to, firstly, hopefully they would be designed in such a way, and a lot of the evidence, at least out of the Fed, the US Federal Reserve, and the European Central Bank, and some of these other big kind of leaders in exploring this space, if they respect people's privacy, if they respect people's sovereignty over their own money and their own financial assets, if they have these types of respects and sort of freedoms built into them, I think that they can be great. I also think that they can be great even if there is some element of oversight happening on the part of the central bank or on the part of individual private banks of a central bank digital currency. As long as CBDCs are not positioned as the only option available to people, as long as they are just one of the options available to people, I think that that's a great world that I would be very happy to live in. I think that the full range of choices should be available to people in terms of how they interact with money and their finances, how they transact with others. And I think that if CBDCs are to be one choice amongst many, amongst the existence of Bitcoin and physical cash and the Visa network and all of these other options that exist, I think that that's great. I think that, again, where it gets scary and hairy to talk about is when we start to consider if CBDCs were to be the only option.
Right. That's a good point. But are you seeing that central banks are exploring actually using like blockchain technology, like distributed ledgers and crypto to create their CBDCs? Like what I've seen is that they're not really thinking about that yet. It's like more of like a closed ledger system that they're thinking about, and that it doesn't look at all like an actual, like, I don't know, cryptocurrency. What are you seeing?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that I would have too much more insight into that than you or anyone else. But I think that my observation would be that it's still very early days for most central banks and that they're trying to explore the full range of options. But even just for myself in reasoning about it, it is tricky to reason about under what circumstances it would make sense for a central bank, I mean, that has the word central in it, to use a decentralized ledger technology. And I think that if it turns out that it's not a blockchain that ends up making sense for CBDCs, then I think that that is a reasonable outcome and actually maybe much better than trying to shoehorn a CBDC onto a ledger that is not fit for purpose. But I will say that a lot of what the conversation seems to be in the United States and policymaking levels, around stablecoins, private stablecoins, so the USDCs of the world, is very exciting to me because it does seem like we're at least maybe, hopefully, trending towards a greater acceptance of stablecoins being, again, an option, a choice to people that is sort of not sanctioned by the government, but sort of has the blessing of the government and a framework dedicated to it that policymakers are on board with. And I think that that's, again, a very exciting development and direction.
Nice. Okay. I like this more optimistic view, less scary about the future.
I hope.
Yeah, I hope so. No, I think so too. To start wrapping up, I love your thoughts on just what the market is looking like for you. Like, you've been a long time kind of analyst, and like you have a really knowledgeable take on like
I'm a trader.
Broad market. Yeah. Sure. So
yeah.
So I mean, today, like, everything is looking awful. Like, there's like red across the board. And this year there's been like so much volatility in general, with like rates going up, and obviously the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And yeah, it seems like there's so many kind of like roadblocks, or like just like different issues looming on the market.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's kind of bound to continue, or like what are the main drivers going forward?
I think that the biggest driver over the next year is going to be macro. And specifically what I mean by macro in this case is rising interest rates. We'll see the ways in which inflation persists. I think that the added volatility of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and also inflation pressures given the price of oil right now on the back of the war going on, I think that those are all going to be the biggest drivers of price action. Mm-hmm. Again, if I look at it on a 3-month, 6-month, 1-year time frame. And I think that is going to cause some pain, particularly in terms of the rising rates. I think that that's going to cause some pain across liquidly traded risk assets in general. And so that's everything from tech stocks to, of course, cryptocurrencies. I think that there's an interesting observation to be made, though, about the kind of bifurcation of private markets versus public markets, where at least in crypto, all of these funds, all of these venture funds with really sticky money over the last 6 months, even 9 months, perhaps, have raised billions of dollars in capital to continue to put towards earlier stage companies and startups and so forth. And to me, I think that that's cause for optimism, both in the sense that there's one part of the market that is going to hopefully be a bit more resilient to those more kind of global macro pressures of rising rates and the war and so forth. And it's also optimistic because those are the investors who are investing on the 10-year time horizon. And I think that it's a good reminder to look out on the 10-year time horizon. I think that you really should not be investing in crypto if you're not looking that far out. And I think that looking out that much farther past this year, which might be a tough year in terms, again, of trading and price action, is a good place to seek the refuge of optimism again. It's hard for me to see a future in which crypto and this technology does not continue to grow and mature and take off.
Yeah, same. Yeah, and I think it makes a lot of sense that, you know, yeah, like so many funds raised billions in at the end of last year, that it's kind of a relief. At least there's that cash waiting to be deployed in crypto, so that we'll continue to see development and innovation and crypto startups get funded. So that's definitely a positive for the space. Awesome. Absolutely. Okay. And then final question is, Jill, what makes you defiant?
What makes me defiant? I love that. I think for me, being in crypto in general, in a way, is an act of defiance, in the sense that, I mean, certainly if I think back 7 or 8 years ago, getting into it, it flew in the face of sort of what was, I guess, expected of what I expected of myself in a way, what was expected of the way that the financial system was going and would continue to develop. And I think for me, what makes me defiant in the sense of motivation comes back to so much of what we talked about in the first half hour of this conversation, where you look around at the world and just the systems for how we transact and interact online are so broken for so many people, whether that's people living in under regimes where they don't actually have free control of their money and finances, whether that's digital creators who don't have real ownership over what they're doing or control over the platforms where that are accruing all of the value for the things that they're creating, whether that's other individuals who are trying to transact across borders. The global remittance market is one that has long been promised to be disrupted by crypto, and we've yet to see it happen. And so all of these types of insights just into the ways that our models, again, of ownership and transaction are broken. And you don't have to go to Latin America to see it. You don't have to go, you know, to Argentina or to Venezuela to see it. You don't have to go to Russia and Ukraine to see it. We can see it wherever we are playing out across the social media platforms or messaging apps or banking apps or lack thereof that we may or may not have access to. I think that that is what drives me in this space. And so that is what makes me defiant.
Awesome. What a great answer. This was a pleasure. Like, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
I love getting to know you a bit better and getting to
Likewise.
Know your new venture. Super interesting. We'll definitely be keeping an eye out for coverage on the Defiant and see how that develops. So thanks again for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Defiant podcast. Together, we are taking hold of the world of DeFi and Web3 with the most influential voices in the space. Don't forget to subscribe to all our channels, our newsletter, YouTube, social media accounts, and of course, this podcast. See you next week.